This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of the show. This is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. After World War II, the United States government launched an effort to promote the peaceful use of nuclear technology. At the same time, some of the scientists who were involved in the design and the manufacture of nuclear weapons set out on a parallel kind of mission. They were interested in persuading people that there were, in fact, peaceful uses for nuclear explosions. Many of these things dealt with landscaping on a massive scale. And in this part of the program, we'll be talking about one such project that was proposed. It was called Project Chariot. It was a plan to create an enormous harbor on the coast of Alaska using nuclear bombs. It was defeated by a small but fierce grassroots effort, an effort that helped to start the environmental movement in the United States. The story, and it's a very interesting story indeed, is told in the book The Firecracker Boys. The subtitle is H-Bombs, Inupiat Eskimos, and the Roots of the Environmental Movement. It is available now in paperback, published by Basic Books, and our guest this morning is the author, Dan O'Neill. Questions are welcome, certainly, as we talk about the subject with Dan O'Neill. And all you need to do to join the conversation is call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief so that we could keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dan O'Neill, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's just a remarkable story, and I think I probably have before said on this program that one of the things for me is great about hosting the show is that I get to learn about things, hear stories, read about them that I've never heard before. And to me, this was a new one. And I expect probably some of the people who are listening would say, yes, they've never heard of this before.
Well, you know, I'd lived in Alaska for quite a number of years before I ever heard of it, too, and I discovered it kind of deep in the university archives, and the story seemed like science fiction or dark comedy, but it was true. And so I started reading in it then, and I guess I never quite finished for the next 7 years.
It certainly seems, and I don't know if it's because today we're more wary of government, or maybe we feel like we have a little bit better understanding of the issues involved with radiation. But it seems to me that I would expect that if you said, look, we have this great idea, we're going to create this massive new harbor, artificial harbor, and we're going to do it in the blink of an eye by exploding a number of nuclear bombs. I would think that people would say, well, that's about the craziest thing that I ever heard. You can't possibly be serious.
If you mean today...
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's true, I think. On the other hand, we seem willing to accept pretty implausible schemes like national missile defense, enormously expensive, almost technically illogical. The system hasn't worked, and we've spent going on $100 billion on the system so far.
Well, I do definitely want to talk about what all the way along here, how this story developed and what the reaction was. But perhaps first, to set a little bit of context, we should go back and talk about the whole idea behind Atoms for Peace, this effort after the war to persuade people that there were indeed peaceful uses for nuclear technology. Nuclear energy certainly was one of them. And then we talk a little bit about Project Plowshare, but maybe just first, how were people thinking about the potential of various kinds of nuclear technology?
Well, yes, after the war ended so dramatically with the detonations in Japan, President Eisenhower began to explore the idea of peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and it was energy at first. And the Atoms for Peace program was one that spread nuclear energy projects, the generation of electricity by fission, into other countries around the world. And actually that ended up being the cause of how countries like India and Pakistan got fissile materials in order to make weapons. But Project Plowshare was an offshoot of that, and it sought to actually make productive use of nuclear explosions themselves, not just energy, but the blasts, and in that way offered perhaps to redeem the bomb. And a number of people felt like a weapon so awesome that had done such horrible destruction just simply had to have a beneficial use, and mightily hoped that it would. And so physicists at the Livermore Weapons Laboratory out in California, led by Edward Teller, the so-called father of the H-bomb, began to explore the idea of using the explosions for what they called geographical engineering. The idea was to reshape the Earth to man's pleasure. Canals could be excavated, mountain passes blasted, ore bodies broken up to facilitate mining and that sort of thing. And they're very interested to showcase this, what they call the sunny side of the atom. And one of the big projects that they imagined was to excavate a new Panama Canal across the Panamanian Isthmus by burying and detonating a very large string of hundreds of nuclear bombs. And so that vessels wouldn't have to queue up in locks to pass over a rise in the land, but could steam through in both directions simultaneously at sea level. And before they could realistically sell that kind of technology abroad, they wanted to test it on American soil. And Alaska became the focus as a place that was very remote, sparsely populated, and perhaps not coincidentally, didn't have an awful lot of political muscle, particularly up in the Eskimo community.
Well, and that gets at the, as you say, they had this idea and they thought, well, we need to do a demonstration project. And first, it probably has to be here in, has to be somewhere in the United States. So they started thinking, well, where could we do this? And I guess you've, in a sense, have answered the in part, the question why it is that they're finally there. They lit on Alaska as the place to do this.
Yeah, I think they really didn't know much about the state and almost nothing at all about the Eskimo people. And they just did a map exercise study looking for a place where there wasn't a deep water harbor. And the idea was to go ahead and blast one. And then they sort of worked backward from there, justifying it. But what happened was just 50 years ago this summer, Edward Teller came north to Alaska unannounced and unveiled this plan to bury six nuclear bombs, thermonuclear bombs, H-bombs, on the coast of Alaska in the extreme northwest near a village called Point Hope, and throw out with that blast 70 million cubic yards of Earth that would be shot as high as the stratosphere. A hole would be made about 2 miles long and a half a mile wide, and the sea would rush in and create this instant harbor. He didn't go to Point Hope. He didn't go to the Inupiat region. He went to the cities in Alaska, and he was greeted with lots of enthusiasm. All the Alaska movers and shakers signed on. The newspaper editors just went wild, enthusing over it. Everybody was looking at federal dollars coming into the state and sort of putting Alaska, kind of a backward little place, not quite yet a state, on the map.
Let me just very quickly introduce again for anybody who might have tuned in the last few minutes, our guest, Dan O'Neill. We're talking about his book, The Firecracker Boys. It's now published in paperback by Basic Books, and indeed it tells the story of Project Chariot. That's what they called it, this project that they were just talking about, that was proposed as a way of demonstrating peaceful uses for nuclear weapons. This was 1958, we're talking about, when this idea was proposed. The idea was to set off a number of nuclear bombs and create an artificial harbor. This was in a remote area of Alaska. And it's really an amazing story. And if you want to read it, you look for the Firecracker Boys. And questions otherwise are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just it makes me think about going back to, I sort of posed this question about what would be the reaction today if such a thing was proposed. I would hope that there would be a fair amount of healthy skepticism. The reaction at the time, although there were people who were skeptical, apparently was generally positive because people saw this as something that had great potential for economic development for the state of Alaska, even though the bombs were going to blow the hole for the harbor. But then the idea was that all of the infrastructure for creating this harbor, that would have to be private money. The government was, I guess it was never the idea that the government was then going to come in and build the harbor for them and everything, put everything in there that you would need. That was up to the people of Alaska.
Yeah, the story kept shifting over time, and it became pretty clear that the Atomic Energy Commission was saying whatever people wanted to hear. But the magic words, the way to shake the money tree in Alaska is, well, it's kind of the reverse, is to talk about jobs for people, federal dollars coming in, and then you have, even today, you know, enormous support. Well, for instance, for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that's something the state of Alaska enthusiastically supports. Almost no political figure in the state can run for office without endorsing that drilling, while the rest of the country opposes it in strong numbers. And there's another enormous mine being proposed for the Bristol Bay region at the headwaters of salmon streams, and this is one of the richest fisheries in the world. So these kind of questions about economic development versus environmental protection still play out today in Alaska, and very frequently the same entities, societal groups, argue the same positions with the same rhetoric that Project Chariot was talked about 50 years ago.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we talk with them, starting with someone here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Just what would have been the fallout, the radiation from detonating five H-bombs?
Yeah, well, it could have been enormously dirty. Over time, they downsized the size of the blast. Originally, they called for 2.4 megatons of energy, and a megaton is the equivalent of a million tons of TNT. So 2.4 megatons, six bombs, would have been the equivalent of 40% of all the firepower expended in all of World War II. If you to get a grasp of the amount of energy, if you imagined it in TNT loaded on one-ton trucks, to bring that much, 2.4 million tons, to Alaska, a convoy of one-ton trucks would stretch from Fairbanks, Alaska, bumper to bumper, to southern Argentina. So something like that would have been enormously dirty because all of the dirt would have been pulverized and irradiated and shot into the stratosphere to circle the globe and fall out where it would, most of it falling out nearby. And it would have significantly contaminated the tundra regions inland from this area where caribou roam and eat lichen. Lichen is a little plant that's built to gather its mineral nutrition from airborne dust. So it was an ideal mechanism to capture fallout. And sure enough, just from atmospheric testing, scientists who launched studies in connection with this Project Chariot, found that caribou were holding many, many times more body burden of radiation than were cattle in the lower states, where there was more fallout on the ground. So what was going on, they learned, was that the ecological system in the Arctic favored rapid uptake of radiation through the food web to man. And it was all linked to the differences between lichen in the north and grasses in the south.
At this time, they were still doing above-ground testing, weren't they, or if they stopped?
Right. They stopped, I think it was 1963, with the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty. Yeah. It was a tremendously interesting series of studies that University of Alaska scientists pushed for before they would okay any such detonation. And in the course of that, they found these ecological relationships that no one had known about before, so that it made detonating this blast in the Arctic much more serious a problem than if it were contemplated for temperate latitudes, because the radiation could move from the lichen to the caribou to man. And the Eskimo people, you know, each Eskimo person might eat more than one caribou a year. So there were many times more radiation in the lichen than there was on the ground. There was more radiation in the caribou than the lichen, and then there was more radiation in the people than in the caribou. It was multiplying as it went up the food chain.
I can remember these grandiose plans that were being put out while I was in high school in the early 50s, and they do seem alarming today. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let me pick up on this matter. How did the Atomic Energy Commission respond to whatever questions people were raising about the possibility of radioactive fallout as a result of these explosions?
Well, they always had a benign a characterization of the plan. Teller would say the fallout will go where we direct it. And, of course, these statements were always mediated by really a sycophantic press. The papers were editorializing things like, here's a quote, "We think the holding of a huge nuclear blast in Alaska would be a fitting overture to the new era which is opening up for our state," meaning statehood. They always referred to the area where it would be shot as a bleak spot located in the wilderness far away. One newspaper editor said, "It's a wilderness with no trees, no nothing. Nobody would want to live there." Well, of course, the Eskimo people had been living there for 10,000 years. It was always understood that the radiation would land where the nuclear scientists said it would. And that's virtually a quote from the newspaper. So even the president of the University of Alaska was saying, if the federal government says this will be all right, there's no reason for concern. So everybody was sort of asked to suspend their ordinary skepticism, and you would think scholars would be loath to do that, but they were being led by opinion shapers who were largely influenced by the prospect of money.
We have some other callers. Let's talk next with somebody up in Cook County, Bartlett. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good topic. I have lived up in Alaska several times, and it's beautiful country, although desolate. I do have a quandary, though. There's people up there are kind of torn. I think most of the natives and locals believe that we ought to be drilling up in Anwar, and they do believe that a lot of what the environmentalists say is falsified or just a negative. Now, because there's no real factual study one way or the other about drilling for oil, which would help that state immensely. They're losing their salmon crop and whatnot. The point I'm trying to bring here, anything that to alter Mother Nature up there, it seems like the environmentalists have got a cap on it. And from what I understand right now, is that we're supposed to, even in the mainland down here, we're supposed to give up surviving in the modern-day world and go back to grass huts because we're polluting the atmosphere. Is there a big push now to try and maybe open up and do some work up there? And as far as nuclear, I grew up actually in a desert in the Southwest close to in Nevada, close to where they used to do a lot of this testing. And to this day, it's so contaminated. They're talking about 10,000-year lifespan, if not longer. And you know, nuclear, to me, nuclear energy is not clean. It may burn clean, but what do you do with the waste? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay, lots to respond to. It's true that with respect to the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that native people in the region who would benefit financially from oil development are generally in favor of it. But to the south of them is the Gwich'in Athabascan people who are very staunchly opposed to drilling in Anwar because the caribou that they rely on breed and calve up on the Arctic coastal plain where the development would occur. So it's not at all monolithic there. With respect to there not being any studies to show the potential consequences to the environment of oil development, no, there's lots of studies, of course, many funded by the oil industry. And also we have history, the example of such things as the catastrophic oil spill of the Exxon Valdez in Prince William Sound, and the effects of that are still hurting fishermen in that region. Talk to any fisherman if you want to talk to a working man in Cordova, Alaska, about what they think about giving industry a blank check to do economic development in wilderness areas, and you'll find a blue-collar man ready to take the other side of that argument. We have, of course, lots of wonderful resources up there, including fish and timber and minerals, gold, not just oil. And we have a challenging problem to try to develop these things sensibly with suitable respect for environmental protection. And in the past, we have had, I'll say we as people who have fought for the environmental protection, we've had to fight for that. We would not have had a pipeline built to quite high environmental standards had we not fought them and insisted that those things be done. So I think it's just a natural tension in the system, and that's good. The people whose principal interest is profit will find themselves at odds with people whose principal interest is the protection of the public's interests. And in the result of all of that, we hope that we come up with reasonable plans to move forward. I think you can hardly grow up in Nevada and witness what the Atomic Energy Commission did to that region and not have a deep suspicion to official pronouncements of safety. The people of the Southwest were routinely pasted with enormous quantities of radiation, and the cancers that developed later proved that, not to mention the documents we've wrested from that agency through the Freedom of Information Act and the statements of whistleblowers. So there's plenty of reason for people to be skeptical and judicious and careful before they sign on to development schemes promoted by industry or government.
We're at a midpoint here. We have a couple of callers we'll get right to, but I'd like to introduce once again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in, Dan O'Neill. He grew up in California, went to UC Berkeley, and then in 1975 moved to Alaska, where he still lives. Did a lot of things there in Alaska, including be a journalist. He was a research associate at the University of Alaska's Oral History Program, where he produced television and some award-winning radio documentaries for public broadcasting. For 4 years, he wrote a political column for the Fairbanks newspaper, and as a result, result of several years of research, he has written a book about Project Chariot. This was a proposal made back in 1958 to demonstrate the potential peaceful uses of atomic weapons. The proposal was to detonate a number of atomic bombs and use that explosion to create an artificial harbor on the coast of Alaska. Due to grassroots opposition, particularly from native peoples in Alaska, the proposal eventually failed. It was not a success and was never done. And it's a remarkable and I think probably for a lot of people, unknown story. And he explores it in depth in his book, The Firecracker Boys. If you want to read it, you go out and look for the book. It's now available in paper. It's published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have some local callers here. Next, someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Yes, it seems the possibilities of generating a tsunami or an earthquake would have been highly probable. Did they appraise that or then or now, the possibilities of those?
Good question, but I think this was so far north of the seismic zone that the earthquakes were not a big worry. However, you're exactly right about three detonations that took place in Alaska on the Aleutian Chain on the island of Amchitka in 69 to 71, that region. And there was a huge worry there over the possibility of tripping massive earthquakes. And that controversy spawned the environmental activist group Greenpeace. And it was the largest anti-nuclear protest in our history, I believe, was the protest of the Kanakan detonation out there in Amchitka. And as it turned out, it did not. They went ahead with the blasts, and they did not trigger big earthquakes, although they were tremendously violent. I think one of them was 5 megaton. That would be the largest detonation ever on North America.
How about the contaminants in the water itself?
At Chariot. Yeah, you know, it's funny. The AEC, Atomic Energy Commission, produced a little film that I just see in my mind right now that showed in profile the excavation of this harbor, and the narrator says, and the radiation would move out of the biosphere, and it shows these little arrows streaming out to sea as if the sea wasn't part of the biosphere. But, yeah, it would have certainly introduced a lot of radioactive contamination into the nearshore waters, and most of the radiation created would degrade quickly. Levels would get low quickly, but there are still these persistent and worrisome radionuclides created by nuclear explosions, things that don't exist in nature except from nuclear explosions, like strontium-90 and cesium-137. And, you know, shortly after atmospheric testing began, every single human being on the planet, every single living organism had these toxins in their bodies. And as I say, in certain ecological situations, these can kind of multiply up the food chain and end up in people in levels that are worrisome. And some of them, like strontium-90, is kind of a calcium analog and so ends up in bones. Now, I mean, you could hold the stuff in your hand and not get hurt, perhaps, but if it's in your bone adjacent to your marrow, irradiating it every day, then you run the risk of developing such things as leukemia. So, I think it would have been, we've seen examples too, like at Bikini Island, where the native people there were moved off the islands supposedly for a short time until the radiation levels calmed down, but they've never been allowed to go back. Well, the once they did go back, they all ended up with plutonium in their urine and were taken off again, as I recall. So I think it would have been a disaster both for the countryside and for the human society out there that's so tied to the land.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go again to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
Good.
I remember the 50s films, you know, where they had the atomic monster and everybody was, you couldn't decide whether the scientists were crazy in the film or were they just, there's the sort of naive character to explain away all the technology. But this part on, you were talking about the your books about the Alaska piece. I did remember reading once about the plan to enlarge and the Panama Canal with nuclear weapons and thought, like, who would think of that? But in reference to the nuclear industry, if there's recent piece on they're building a new sarcophagus for Chernobyl,
uh-huh.
And they built it in two pieces on train tracks, and they're going to push it, and then the people that are going to weld it together can only work there like 15 minutes, so that'll show you the indicate how extremely dangerous that place is. But it's just amazing that they would think of this. I mean, was it published? Was it like a politically, I mean, was it obviously a congressional bill? Who paid for this, the AEC, or who was supposed to pay for this deal? Do you have a know about that?
Well, yeah, it was the Atomic Energy mm-hmm. Commission in the post-war had virtually unlimited access to money and political power. I mean, I had people from Livermore say this to me in so many words. We could do whatever we want. We didn't think we were necessarily even beholden to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy in the Congress. He said, when we felt like it, we just went around them. We had unlimited budget and unlimited power. We did what we wanted to do. And that was the sort of feeling about, if you can kind of remember the craze surrounding atomic matters in those days. I mean, it became a pop culture phenomenon where there was atomic everything, from atomic cocktails and just movies, like you say, with monsters, and the atomic scientists sort of became the high priests of science, and they were looked to solve problems quite beyond their area of training and into cultural matters. And so they just had cachet and power and money, and they had never been thwarted. This was the first time that the Atomic Energy Commission ever didn't get to do what it wanted to do, was this little protest that rose up out of a single Eskimo village. So I think that kind of...
That in itself is amazing. Can I ask you one other question? Do you follow I know they did a lot of atmospheric testing about 45 years ago. I'm sure there's still stuff in the atmosphere related to that. I might have gone into the oceans, but I know we're all polluted with that stuff now, but do you know the extent of that? Does anybody talk about that anymore?
The extent of...
Yeah, of, you know, the... radiation, you know, how we have the strontium-90 and
fallout
matter and stuff in the atmosphere from that, you know, they were blowing bombs about 10, 20 times a year in the atmosphere, and I'm wondering if there's still that stuff in the atmosphere, you know, that's affecting us now.
You know, I am not familiar. I couldn't really answer that. My guess is that there still is stuff circling the globe and falling out, but
yeah.
I think typically the suspension time was shorter than the...
There is, you know, it's a biosphere, so you basically it goes into the ground and goes in the groundwater. I know it's probably not enough to really affect everybody, but the idea that they would want to blow a hole in the ground of the size you're speaking of and eject that into the atmosphere is just incredibly, almost like insane. You know what I mean? I wonder if people 50 years or 100 years from now are going to think we're insane for polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide now. Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Bye.
It's something that I want to get to, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that here in the immediate post-war era, the United States government was interested in promoting the peaceful use of nuclear technology, particularly nuclear energy production. and that the scientists who were involved in designing building nuclear weapons wanted to kind of get in on that, and that's where we get to Project Plowshares, which was hatched at Lawrence Livermore Lab, and as you explained, one of the people that was important mover in this was Edward Teller. Now, this was, again, here the idea was to promote peaceful uses for nuclear weapons. However, having said all that, was there a connection between Project Plowshares and the desire of people who built nuclear weapons to continue to design and test nuclear weapons?
You bet. Bingo. what they had said, you know, when they promoted these things was a lot of rah-rah talk about economic development. In the case of Chariot, they were talking about the value to commercial fishing of a safe haven and also the opportunity to export minerals, particularly coal, from that region. Neither thing was really true. The coal was hundreds of miles away and would have required the construction of a railroad that long across Arctic tundra, and it's just not economically possible. But at another level, there was the issue of testing out this technology before they could export it to Panama and Australia and other places around the world where they wanted to do it, and on our continent as well. But at the deepest level, I believe, and I found evidence to show, that the reason for all this, after all, the people whose business it is to make nuclear weapons don't precisely have a portfolio to do civil engineering. So why are these bomb builders so avid about civil engineering projects? And the reason was to cultivate a climate of world opinion more favorable to testing, particularly in light of an emerging movement to ban atmospheric tests or maybe tests altogether, a comprehensive test ban. And so as that movement began to get traction, as people started to notice strontium 90 in baby teeth in the 50s, then the response from Teller, and this is classic Edward Teller, was a little bit of jujitsu, in which he would now turn this technology into something important in the peaceful realm, and that it would be a crime against humanity to thwart this promising technology that could bring wealth to poor people and facilitate commerce and mining and so on. And so I believe that the real reason people like Teller and his colleagues wanted to push peaceful nuclear explosions was to keep it exempt from any sort of provisions of a test ban. And that way they could keep the weapons laboratories open, even with a test ban, because they would now be making peaceful bombs. And they could keep the lab staffed, they could keep the budgets intact. And then when the political climate shifted or the Russians broke some agreement, they could switch right back to making nuclear weapons.
One of the things I want to make sure that we talk about is the opposition within the Native community to Chariot. And as we have discussed, it seems to us now a crazy idea, but at the time, a lot of people in Alaska, the business community, the political community was behind it. The media, mainstream media, supported it. Even people within the academic scientific community at University of Alaska, not all of them, but a lot of them did. And it seemed that perhaps the most important source of opposition was the Native community. And who knows, if it had not been for them, what would have happened?
Well, it's really an interesting story because what happened was that the Livermore people picked the exact worst place to site their project, and that was near the village of Point Hope, because Point Hope is a very special village, a very different kind of place, and the people there are just famous for being independent-minded and tough. And they were, in way back in historic times, the rulers of that whole region. They were warlike, and they were interested to consolidate their power. At any rate, when the Atomic Energy Commission finally did come up, a couple of years after this had been being promoted in Alaska, finally did come up to the villages in this region, they were met with substantial acquiescence from all of the villages where they made a presentation, except Point Hope. Point Hope was opposed unanimously. They wouldn't be deterred. Nothing the Atomic Energy Commission could say moved them a degree. But meanwhile, all the other villages, some of them almost as near to ground zero as Point Hope, you know, were asking questions about what kind of jobs would be available. So that it was really interesting. It wasn't kind of a uniform protest on the part of the native peoples, but of this one particular village. Mm. But they led shortly the rest of the Inupiat people, and then later the Athabascan people, into a political activism to organize in defense of their lands, and this was the precipitating cause of that. But then, too, they had tremendous allies in a handful of conservationists, as they were called back then, in the Fairbanks area, people who lived out in little log cabins and had a hand-crank mimeograph machine, and started a little club called the Alaska Conservation Society. And they churned out bulletins about this Project Chariot and just sent it out in the mail all around the country, just hoping it would get some traction, and it did. It was sort of classic grassroots protest. And the third prong of this attack was the scientists, biologists, mainly at the University of Alaska, who just could see the environmental consequence. I was explaining a little bit about the lichen and these food chain webs, and they saw that this would cause tremendous problem for the native people, and they risked their jobs to stand up in opposition to the Atomic Energy Commission. They tried to do it through channels with their research, but when the AEC mischaracterized their research and said that it wasn't showing that there were problems, and when their university president wouldn't back them up, but instead fired them, they became important opponents of the project. They lost their jobs at the university. There's evidence they were blacklisted from working elsewhere at colleges when both the University of Alaska president and the Atomic Energy Commission intervened at their new places of employment. And so anyway, it was together with the people of Point Hope, conservationists in Fairbanks, and the scientists within the University of Alaska, they finally began to get some attention outside in the lower states and some publicity. And little by little, the thing snowballed until it became, I think, too big a public relations problem for the Atomic Energy Commission to push through. Plus, Kennedy had come in. He had a new kind of scientist advisor, much less bellicose people, and they were not interested in necessarily touching off this bomb on the doorstep of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple of callers here, and I wanted to try to get to at least one of them. I want to go to line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I knew somebody who graduated from college about 66, went to the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. I was a geologist, and then because it was Vietnam War, signed up with the Army Corps of Engineers. And he ended up in being sent very quickly to Vietnam after he blew the whistle on a similar idea, which I can't quite remember the details. The Army Corps of Engineers wanted to do something down in the lower 48 in the West, something about a digging in a canal or something with nuclear energy, by exploding bombs. And it might have been an underground. I'm sorry, I can't remember the details, but it seems like the idea didn't quite go away. But when he blew the whistle, and I think he told the Sierra Club, they wanted to know who it was that spilled the beans, and he admitted to doing it, and the next day he was on the way to Vietnam.
I don't know. There were projects proposed in the lower states, like somewhere in Southern California, they talked about blasting out a mountain pass and running a freeway through there with nuclear explosions. And then that, there was one proposed, I think there was a big rock in the Mississippi they were talking about blowing up. But it can get kind of wild, the kinds of things that were proposed. But Chariot was the one that came the closest. And just, I don't know if this helps, but right after Project Chariot in Alaska, around 64-ish, for a couple of years, there was a proposal to create a dam on the Yukon River that would have impounded water larger than Lake Erie. It was taken about 30 years to fill. And that became the next big environmental conflict in Alaska after Chariot. So I don't know if that might be something he was involved in. The Corps of Engineers was involved in that.
No, I don't. I think it's a little bit too early. But in any case, the idea seems to not have gone away by the time of the Vietnam War. Thank you.
All right. Let's go on. We'll try and catch here again line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. The big push by the defense industry now seems to be the bunker buster bomb. And I'm just wondering, what would be the environmental effect of using such weapons? It seems to me they'd put a tremendous amount of radiation into the environment.
I'm not expert on that, other than I believe isn't one of the components of that to use extremely heavy metals, like depleted uranium, for example, to have enough momentum to penetrate deeply into the earth and the bunker before the explosion occurs. And I guess there is quite a bit of worry about the use of stuff, such stuff as depleted uranium. But I really, I'm not too up on that. I think the analog that I see these days is the National Missile Defense, which was actually deployed now in Alaska. They built silos and have installed missiles. I mean, they've built it before it's actually been tested. The radars are not in place. The satellites are not in place. The system cannot work, and yet we have built and installed the missiles, hoping that eventually all the parts will come together and it'll work.
Well, if we can only talk our adversaries into putting homing devices on their missiles, it will work.
Well, that's what we do in our tests. We actually put homing beacons on the target missiles, although that's not widely reported. But the New York Times did report that the tests have been substantially dumbed down.
We have a couple minutes left, and you know, something that I would like to have you talk about at least for a little bit is the ways in which you think that this story and how it played out did indeed help to lay some of the foundation for an environmental movement in the United States.
Well, it's it was really interesting. One of the people that the Alaskans got a hold of in the States was Barry Commoner, then a plant physiologist in St. Louis. And he began to see, as he went to the library and looked up lichens and how they worked, that this was an issue related to work he had been doing with atmospheric fallout from nuclear testing, but so much broader, because it had to do with the whole interconnectedness of things, the ecology. And what he did was shift his focus away from atmospheric testing to the environment, and shifted the name of his publication from Nuclear Information to Environment, a journal that still exists today. And he really became then the leader of the environmental movement throughout the late 60s, and by 1970 in the first Earth Day, he was on the cover of Time magazine as the apparent leader of this new movement. Here's what he said to me. He said, looking back on my career in environmentalism, it's absolutely certain that it began when I went to the library to look up lichens in connection with Chariot. I realized we were dealing with an ecosystem here. And I think insofar as I had an effect on the development of the whole movement, Project Chariot can be regarded as the ancestral birthplace of at least a large segment of the environmental movement. Well, that's just one example, but the whole idea that conservationism, which was mostly concerned with protecting magnificent landscapes and wildlife species that might be endangered, now was being informed by ecological science, that invisible interconnectedness, a more holistic view, was something which was going to inform the activism of people who wanted to protect the environment. And Chariot was the first battle waged in those terms. And also the studies that were commissioned by the AEC, that were insisted upon by the University of Alaska faculty, became the first de facto environmental impact statement. And that was done a decade before that term was invented or the National Environmental Policy Act was passed, and people started to codify what had been done in the Chariot program. So those are a couple of, and then throughout the book I mentioned some other links.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of the time. It is a great story, and I would suggest to folks you go out and look for this book, The Firecracker Boys, the subtitle H-Bombs, Inupiat Eskimos, and the Roots of the Environmental Movement. It's the story of Project Chariot, this proposal back in 1958 to use nuclear bombs to create an artificial harbor in Alaska. It's now available in paperback. It's published by Basic Books by our guest, Dan O'Neill. And Dan, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.